You're listening to episode 316 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hello, Max. We finally hit winter here, I think, because I'm chilled to the bone today, and only next week we're supposed to be in the high 60s. I don't get it.
It's crazy. It's very crazy.
But we got a lot of good news stories this week. We've got Japan Airlines and drones. DJI takes the gloves off. This is in reference to the FAA regulations that have come out. The need for unmanned standards. A flood of drones shut down the airspace over a fatal crash. The Army launches a new counter-drone offensive. Drone stalking. And mystery drone and mass hysteria. But I guess we should get started, Max. What do you think?
All right, David, let's get started.
Well, our first story comes from Parcel and Post Technology International.com. Japan Airlines in Yabu City in Japan to trial UAV delivery. So, Max, you're the Japan expert. How dense is Yabu in Japan for trial of drone delivery?
Well, most of Japan is pretty dense. I haven't been to Yabu City, but Japan Airlines has made it known that they want to get into the delivery service by drones. They want to offer a medical supply delivery service to remote areas. Meanwhile, Yabu City has been using drones for agricultural applications, and they want to expand into other fields like disaster and logistics and medical care assistance. So the two are getting together for a trial.
And they're using Terra Drone Corporation, and they're demonstrating UAV transporting relief supplies to mountainous areas. Again, medical, UAVs and medical is going to be the trend for the year. It's definitely going to be the earliest thing to be delivered.
It's really shaping up that way. And the two expect to begin this trial or these trials pretty soon in the spring of 2020. So that's only a few months away, I guess, as we record this. And they're going to fly over a 25-kilometer route from a hospital to a clinic to simulate an event, a disaster, some kind of weather or some issue that requires shipment of emergency supplies. And that's kind of where they're heading with this.
And again, I guess we're talking about spoke and hub delivery, where this clinic might be sending supplies or samples back to the hospital and the hospital sending out supplies to that clinic. It sounds like they've got a fixed route, so they're not trying to do any sort of maneuvering in the airspace, though I can imagine Japan's airspace is pretty crowded. And I don't know what Japan's beyond visual line of sight regulations are, but evidently they must be less strict in Japan than they are here in the States.
And here we see another example of a large company, somebody that's traditionally in the transportation business of some sort or another, Japan Airlines in this case, having interest in this. And I mean, this is maybe that's the other trend for these days, David, is we see lots of large corporations, legacy organizations that provide some kind of service, some kind of transportation service, looking to expand into unmanned aircraft, or at least getting involved enough so that if something really takes off here, they won't be left behind.
This kind of deliveries thing would be here in the States, would be taken over by like Federal Express or UPS. So those services that are strictly delivery, I believe Japan Air has a delivery aspect that they would want to leverage drones for beyond their passenger normal flying. I'm sure that they have a cargo division that looks to, which would be the part that's reaching into the drone industry. So, but let's talk a little bit about who's doing it. And it's the quote, world's number one industrial drone solution provider. And that's TerraDrone. And they're headquartered in Japan, providing services worldwide, a large drone service provider providing aerial survey, drone-based infrastructure inspection, and drone data processing and analysis. The city and the airline are leveraging a third party with the experience to get all three to integrate into a seamless delivery system.
It does seem like a good link up between the three of them.
So the next one is from DJI. DJI's statement on U.S. Department of Interior's drone order. Now, we know that the Department of Interior has sent out an order saying that Chinese drones are not to be used currently by the Department of Interior because they consider them security risks. And of course, that Department of Interior had a large quantity of DJI drones. So DJI responded. And Max, what was their politically direct response?
It is a direct response. DJI says that DJI is extremely disappointed by the U.S. Department of the Interior order, which inappropriately treats a technology's country of origin as a litmus test for its performance, security, and reliability. And then they go on. This action will ground the entire DOI, Department of Interior, drone program, which relies on drones made with globally sourced components to create the federal government's largest and most innovative civilian drone fleet. They say the decision makes clear that the U.S. government's concerns about DJI drones, which make up a small portion of the DOI fleet, have little to do with security and are instead part of a politically motivated agenda to reduce market competition and support domestically produced drone technology, regardless of its merits. So without diving too deep into the potential politics of this, DJI is saying what other people have said or wondered about, that being actions in the United States by the government with regard to certain Chinese companies, in this case DJI, that maybe that's more of a political motivation than anything else. I think that it's kind of unusual for a company like DJI to be this direct in public. I mean, I think that behind the scenes, that you might find them expressing their strong displeasure. But usually, companies tend to play nice in public. DJI is being, pretty direct here.
Yeah, and part of me says I don't blame them, but part of me says that the tact they're using probably isn't the best way to address the situation. I think they need to set about a way of proving to the DOI, which is really following the lead of the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense has flagged drones produced overseas as a security risk. The Department of Interior followed up on that. And DJI, if they're going to play in this environment, and they are dominant in the environment, they're going to have to illustrate that they are sensitive to priority data. The worry is that the drones are transmitting data back to their home, their country of origin, and not necessarily at the permission of or awareness of the operators. So I guess it's transparency has got to come from DJI.
They are pretty direct, though, David. They call these restrictions politically motivated. They say the restrictions are masquerading as cybersecurity concerns. And what they'd like to see, they say in this piece, is that policymakers and industry stakeholders create clear standards, they say, that will give commercial and government drone operators the assurance they need to confidently evaluate drone technology on the merits of performance, security, and reliability, no matter where it is made. So, I mean, that's nice, but if the U.S. position is politically motivated and an effort to negotiate, you know, with, in this case, China, playing nice, I mean, it's not going to get them anything, I don't think. So they're in a tough spot. This is a real challenge for the DJI public relations, communications, and legal department, I think.
But again, politically, I mean, yes, there's right now we are in effectively here in the United States in a trade war with China, which is reaching just about all aspects of public life here in the States, I'm sure, as well overseas in China. So it's a matter of taking time and working through the problem. And let's hope that a solution can come out, because DJI is the Hershey's chocolate of the world, or whatever you want to call it. They are the number one doing what they're doing, you know, and a large portion of their volume comes from the United States. Let's hope that level heads prevail and we get some really good standards set up like they suggested in the letter, which dovetails nicely into our next article.
This is from Commercial UAV News. Developing drone standards is key to successful growth in the UAV industry. So in this article, they reiterate some things that we know, of course, all of you listening know, that the potential UAV market is huge. They point out that growth depends on having public standards, frameworks, and certifications. And as an example of that, they talk about how about almost 12 months ago, the Drone Advisory Council of CompTIA released something called Drone Standards and Best Practices, which is directed to companies, and it tries to lay out some of the parameters for implementing UAS operations internally or through outsourcing. But they note that still there's a lot of work to be done before realizing the full economic benefits from unmanned aviation.
And a lot of this we've heard before. Of course, the drone industry needs to work closely with government regulators. Further measures need to be identified and discussed, like drone security, data security, vendor-neutral UAV frameworks or protocols. That's something we haven't really touched about yet. There doesn't seem to be a universal standard for that yet. Need more formality in industry norms and lack of regulation with an emphasis on remote ID. But I do think the vendor-neutral UAV framework, I think, is going to be kind of interesting, because that right now, the UAV framework and that stuff is so proprietary. It's sort of going to be interesting if we get standardizations that loosen that proprietary nature.
Now, CompTIA is a nonprofit IT organization, and the membership is made up of hardware and software manufacturers and developers, mapping software developers, platform providers, even insurance companies, drone pilots, instructors, a whole spectrum of folks. And I think that they admit that when you have something new, a new technology like drones, just to use that term generically, in the beginning, there is very little standards. Everybody is trying to develop new things, explore new technologies, trying to, you know, figure all this out. And at some point in time, as that industry develops, there comes a time and a need for these kinds of standards and protocols and the rules that everybody can play under. And they believe that that time has come in this industry. I don't know if it has or not, personally. I mean, regulations, yes, some of it. I think there's a lot more creativity still yet to come, but I could be convinced either way. But the punchline here, I think, and the reason that this article is talking about all this, is that the chief technology evangelist for CompTIA, which is James Stanger. Well, he's going to represent that organization and their members by interfacing with the AIA, the Aerospace Industries Association. And they say that the AIA is looking to focus on finding a compromise that helps grow the industry. They would like to have standard protocols completed by the second or third quarter of 2020. And then with that in place, go on to have discussions about possible certifications and training standards and things like that. So I think that's great. I think it might be a little ambitious. And as I said a minute ago, it might not quite be time for that yet, but not a bad time to start, I guess.
Well, it is ambitious. We'll say that, given that we've been dealing with this now for as long as we have. What I would say is your argument about if it's time or not and the industry's mature enough, you know, maybe it's a shoot for the stars and maybe you'll land on the moon. You know, I kind of take that.
Yeah.
Kind of take that kind of approach that, okay, it may be overreaching, but you might get a lot farther trying to overreach than you would be doing up in small steps. I think our small steps, incremental way that drones have been growing, or as far as regulation goes and standards goes, small incremental steps is got to get some oomph to it, and maybe stop tiptoeing around and starting accelerating, you know, taking deep steps, you know, okay, we're standing up now. Let's start walking. We've been crawling for a long time now and our knees are worn out.
Yeah.
You know, so it's okay. We got to stand up. We got the wobble going. It's starting to move forward. You know, let's get from toddling to walking. Us people flying drones, you know, there are animals that are able to walk a couple of minutes after they are born. Let's get this industry up and walking. What do you think, Max?
Yeah, no, good analogy. I like that.
See, and you were worried that I didn't have enough energy before the show started. The next one's kind of heartbreaking. Here in the States, we lost a great person, a hero to a lot of people. Kobe Bryant, the basketball player of the Lakers, grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, before he went to play. We played for Lower Merion before he went off to join the Lakers in the NBA. It was really kind of sad that my Twitter feed on Sunday when this accident occurred was double loaded because I was getting all the Philadelphia fans compared to all of the aviation people who were just as disheartened because there was a helicopter crash. This is a sad, you're grounded story because the moment the accident occurred, which right now the leading indication is it was a controlled flight into terrain because of weather, the whole area was then loaded with drones trying to get video footage of the crash site, which caused the FAA and local airspace to get shut down, which delayed reaching the accident scene.
Yeah, it really is unfortunate. I mean, well, of course, the accident is unfortunate. 9 people died in the helicopter crash. Very unfortunate. You know, a great individual was lost. And I guess, you know, these days, in the times of cell phone videos of, you know, any even mildly interesting event, it's kind of not unexpected that a lot of people's first reaction would be to launch their drones and go up on the mountain and try to see what they could see. But it's, you know, a lack of awareness that doing so hampers the authorities and first responders from getting in there. So, you know, clearly the general public doesn't understand that drones and first responders don't mix. It was very unfortunate. I don't even know if anybody's going to learn any lessons as a result of this, or if the next time, you know, we have something of such a great public interest take place, the drones will go up again.
Which is one reason why there's such a strong counter UAS industry that's growing, which leads us to our next story, which is from nationaldefensemagazine.org, Defense Department to stand up new counter drone office. Evidently, the threat of weaponized UASs, and we're talking small, you know, we already knew about the threat of weaponized UASs of the large scale international medium endurance, long, high altitude, you know, male predators, reapers, herons. But this is talking about small prosumer or even pro size UASs and the threat of those in a terrorism environment.
There's an interesting quote that captures where the U.S. military is coming from on this. This is from the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, Ellen Lord. And she said, quote, "We see that small UAS are becoming a more popular weapon of choice, and we need to be agile and pivot to that challenge." So what's forming up here is this new counter UAS office that's going to be created, put under the U.S. Army. It's going to be headquartered in Northern Virginia and staffed by about 60 people. So it's a good-sized organization.
So, yeah, I mean, 60 people is a good nucleus, and we don't exactly know what they're charged with other than developing counter UAS systems. But it's interesting that it was placed under the Army and not the Air Force. But I guess that's because the Air Force is too busy trying to create its own new department underneath it called the U.S. Space Force. But it will reach into, besides the Department of the Army, into the other services, the Navy and the Department of the Navy and the Department of the Air Force. 3 to 5 systems that's best for the military. You know how the military loves to have systems that are equipped across the services. It works always so well, i.e. F-35.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's their objective. They're looking to come up with 3 to 5 systems. And I guess they're evaluating them now. They're taking a look at the possibilities now. And they hope to have that result in around the April time frame, and then down select from all of the possibilities, down select to 3 to 5, which I don't know how they come up with 3 to 5. I mean, certainly I think one system is that's not the right answer. And multiple systems for different scenarios, different threats, makes a lot of sense to me. But I can't really explain why 3 to 5, but that's their objective.
Well, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, one for each.
Oh, you think that's it?
No, I say that lightly in jest, but 3 to 5, you could see the top scenarios I have would be a larger perimeter defense system that you would set up at a military installation, like an Air Force base. You would want sort of a man portable rapid deployment one for the Army and the Marines, and then maybe one optimized for sea surface warfare, which would be for the Navy and the Coast Guard. So there's three right there to be looking at it across the board for a practical sense. Adding two more, that's not a big a deal. But as much as they'd like to get down to one, I don't think there's... Every time we've tried to get down to one thing to do everything, it turns out to be a complete nightmare. And the only thing that's ever worked properly like that is called the Swiss Army knife. So, I have to admit, my Swiss Army knife, my Victor Knox Swiss Army knife, if I still have from Scouts after 40 some odd years, but complete with it, still has its toothpick. But that being said, 3 to 5 seems optimal. Okay, Max, why do we need counter UAS? Well, because evidently in Maine, they're using drones to stalk people.
Yeah, this is something new. This comes about from a woman in Maine, in Gorham, Maine, and she says a drone has been following her around. Now, the first occurrence was when she was driving at night, I think from work back to home, and she noticed that she was being followed in her car by a drone. So she stopped at a gas station, didn't get out of the car, called the police. The police arrived, and the police officer also saw the drone. In fact, it even started following him.
So, okay, clearly the woman is not making this up, because the next day, the drone followed her as she drove 8 miles to her brother's house. So someone's got quite the drone if they're flying a pattern of 8 miles beyond visual line of sight. And then she called the police again, and sure enough, the police arrived and saw said drone stalking her. I don't know what to make of this story, but it's just sort of creepy, sort of Stephen King-ish. I don't know.
Yeah.
Of all of the privacy drone stories, this one's getting kind of creepy. You know, maybe we need to talk to our friend Micah in Maine about what's going on up there, that they're suddenly having drones flying around stalking people.
And it is really concerning.
But let us not be said that there aren't UFOs doing strange things in Maine or UASs, but let's go back to talking about our Colorado UAVs, and maybe they weren't UAVs.
This is something that we talked about a few weeks ago, or maybe started a few weeks or a month ago, where people were seeing all of these drones, what they said were drones. And the public was seeing them. Law enforcement was seeing them. It seems like almost everybody was seeing them, and nobody knew what they were. The military said it's not us. Everybody said it's not us. And so we haven't heard too much lately. Well, NBC affiliate KUSA in Denver says that, at least in that area, these things have pretty much all disappeared, that the sightings have dropped off significantly. And they don't know why. Some people are saying, oh, it's a cover-up. Someone's not saying what's really going on. Another possibility is the drone just left. Another possibility is, well, maybe there never were any drones. So, in fact, the Colorado Department of Public Safety issued a press release, and they said most of these reports weren't drones at all, but other things.
This is what we call in the UFO world a flap. Multiple sightings that begin abruptly and end abruptly. No one knows why, but that's what it is. But there's a follow-on story from Vice.com, which says, Motherboard says it was a classic case of mass hysteria. Again, they reference the CDPS. No incidents involving criminal activity, nor have investigations substantiated reports of suspicious or illegal drone activity. There were 23 reports between January 6th and January 13th. 13 were determined to be planets, stars, and or small hobbyist drones. 6 were commercial aircraft, and 4 remain unconfirmed, otherwise known as a UFO. None of the 90 reports from November 23rd onward were confirmed instances of illegal drone activity. However, there were drones spotted in that list.
Right. Some of them were noted to be small hobbyist drones. But, I don't know. I was hoping for something a little different in terms of the outcome. I mean, Motherboard calls this a classic case of mass hysteria. Was it? Well, I don't know. Maybe. This will all, maybe. It wouldn't be the first time that's happened. Although, you know, from the reports we've all been reading, it's hard to imagine that people were imagining things that were different than what they thought they were seeing, at least on that scale. But I don't think, unless these things reappear, I don't think we're going to hear much more about this, and this might be the end of the story.
You know, until 45 years from now, where the government releases the classified information saying the drones were causing all sorts of controversy and were spraying chemtrails, you know, causing crop circles, which, okay, I'm making fun now, but it is an interesting case study on what happens when people see things and see a lot of things. So we'll leave that note. I apologize because my co-host hasn't adapted the X-File music for this story. But I guess on that note, we'll ease out going, you know, it's the Twilight Zone. So if you want, you can follow in the show notes. Where, Max?
We're at the UAVDigest.com, and you'll find show notes there. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, just type in the UAVDigest.com/316.
You can find us on Twitter at UAVDigest. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/UAVDigest. You can join our Slack listener team by sending us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. But most of all, if you listen to us on any of your major pod catchers like Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Stitcher.com, leave us some feedback there so that people can find us going forward. So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you so much for listening.